Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. Train derailments across the U.S. are splashed across the headlines right now. Dozens of passengers on rail in Greece have perished in another derailment. Tonight, we'll talk to one of America's leading rail experts to learn a little bit about why this is happening seemingly more and more. All right, let's get into the MO. The recent chemical freight train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, has sparked global interest and examination of the safety of rail systems in the U.S. and all around the world. Then just weeks after that fire and toxic chemical spill in from this Norfolk Southern-owned train across the ocean over in Greece, a passenger train crashed into a freight train head-on before derailing and killing 57 riders. Most of those who died were in their teens and 20s. While these two tragedies stem from different causes, for many around the world, rail is a vital lifeline and the only mode of transportation available, be it because air travel is cost prohibitive or train stations are just more accessible. Rail, be it for people or products, keep every major economy moving. In the U.S., train travel demand pales in comparison to air. But elsewhere in the world, trains are the preferred mode of travel, and governments are putting billions into that venture. Like in China, by contrast, the rail travel industry there is booming. Chinese rail ridership has steadily increased over 8% year over year every year for the last decade, according to the World Bank. But that's because China is the global leader in HSR, high-speed rail. China has built over 25,000 kilometers of HSR lines and now boasts more commuter travel by rail than Europe or even Japan. These HSR lines are 95% on time, so with speeds between 200 kilometers to 350 kilometers an hour, HSR is the preferred mode of commuting for many Chinese who live outside of the city, taking just about an hour or so to travel 150 kilometers. Price and affordability for those tickets? Comparable to long-distance bus fare here in the U.S. And as far as HSR derailments, few and far between, with only one HSR derailment in southern China reported in 2022. So with as many trains traveling in China, how can there be only one derailment, you might wonder? So for that, we'll talk to a leading rail expert in the U.S. and, in fact, internationally. Dr. Alan Zaramsky is a professor and the director of Railway Engineering and Safety Program at the University of Delaware. He's also the author of Art and Science of Rail Grinding. Dr. Zaramsky has actually consulted for years on some of these rail projects in China, going as far back as the 1990s. Dr. Zaramsky, thank you so much for being with us. So first, Dr. Zaramsky, I'd like to talk to you about passenger rail, both domestically and abroad. So let's start over in France, for example, where the Prime Minister of France, Elizabeth Borne, told Reuters that her country plans on investing 100 billion euros in rail transport by the year 2040. Now, it's not clear at this point if that would only be for passenger rail or the entire rail system in general, but this project is aimed at decreasing France's carbon footprint. Can you talk to us a little bit about the role that trains play in the way of going green and also in linking financially disadvantaged areas or communities to the major cities, which the French say will actually open up opportunity for those folks?
Okay, so to start off with, railroads are definitely considered part of the green environment. I like to tell my students that this 1800 technology that people imagine with the spewing steam engines of the past is now one of the most green type of transportation modes in the world. Railroads A lot of the high-speed railroad system, in fact, virtually all the high-speed railroad systems in the world use electric power. So as a result, the source of energy can be anything, hydroelectric, geothermal, solar, any source of energy that you'd like can be used for the overhead catenary power for passenger rail. In addition to that, railroads are working with trying to introduce hydrogen locomotives as another form of green energy, and even the you know the those that use diesel electric locomotives, they're very, very heavily filtered, and the emissions are significantly less than alternate transportation modes, particularly truck type of modes. Well, trains have historically done several things in improving the economics of countries. First of all, it's opened up undeveloped areas. China is a classical case where railroads were used to open up vast parts of the country to allow people to access. As far as opening up disadvantaged communities and allowing them to come into the city to work, commuter railway has been traditionally doing that for decades. And what we've been seeing recently is even high speed rail has been used to bring people actually fairly long distances into the city. In Japan, people are actually commuting 100, 100 miles or so, I guess we're working kilometers, 150 kilometers or so, by high speed rail to come into work in the morning and back in the evening. So what tends to happen is that people who can't afford to live in very expensive cities can live further out in less expensive communities. People with lower incomes or who don't have the earning power, and then they can use trains to commute into work at a reasonable cost and commute out from work at a reasonable cost. And that tends to provide a more equitable form of transportation. Railroads seem to be a very equitable form of transportation in that it does not require you to own automobiles, but you can, for the price of your ticket, you can literally go anywhere to work or to a neighboring town or to even do longer distance transportation.
The global high-speed rail or bullet train market was valued at approximately $43 billion in 2021 and is projected to hit $77.6 billion by the year 2031. China is leading the way in this sector at present. If you can, explain for us in layman's terms the differences between HSR versus standard rail systems, such as those that we have here in the U.S. now. I mean, why don't we have HSR here in the U.S.?
Okay, so let's talk about the distance, the differences. The difference is primarily speed. High-speed rail, as people commonly think of it, generally are speeds of about 180 to 200 miles per hour, or about 300 to about 340 kilometers per hour. There, the high, the next level down tends to be between about 110 and 150 miles an hour. With a large population between 125 and 150 miles an hour. So that's about what, 200 to 250 kilometers per hour. And then you have conventional trains, the more conventional trains, which will be operating at 70, 80, 90 miles an hour. So you're looking at 120, 140 kilometers per hour. In the United States, we have trains that go up to about 150 miles per hour at the present time. So that's about 250 kilometers per hour. That's the Amtrak on the Northeast Corridor. We're currently building the California high-speed rail system, which is going to go closer to the 180 mile per hour area, but we don't have that in operation yet. One of the reasons is because the distances between major cities in the U.S. outside of the Northeast Corridor and outside of California, where we do have some form of higher speed rail, the distances are quite high. So even when you're going 3,000 miles, if you want to go from New York to California, even at 200 miles an hour, it's still a fairly long trip, and airplanes do it much faster. So for the time being, we have not developed in the U.S. a true transcontinental high-speed rail system, but the direction we're moving towards is putting regional high speeds in place to sort of emulate the Northeast Corridor, maybe a little bit faster in other parts of the country. California is building it now. They're looking at Texas. They're looking at the Midwest. They're looking at the Southeast. In fact, there is a high-speed rail system now being built, or a higher-speed rail system now being built in Florida. Going from Miami to Orlando, that's under construction by Brightline. That's going to be about 150 miles an hour. Los Angeles, Las Vegas is getting to the point where they're going to be starting to do something serious here soon. They're probably going to be in the 150 mile an hour range. And I fully expect the U.S. to start moving towards the 180 to 200 mile an hour high speed range territory over the next couple of decades. But at the moment, the demographics still favor the air system. When you're going very long distances in the U.S.
Yes, the Northeast Corridor. We have the Acela Amtrak system here. I take that from time to time. All right. Coming up next, train tracks. They're just tracks, right? Or are some safer than others? We're going to discuss it with Dr. Alan Zaremski. He'll explain it. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Взрывы в центре города. Есть раненые.
Два удара было нанесено по Запорожской атомной станции.
Атомная станция превратилась в инструмент шантажа, в инструмент удовлетворения амбиций, решения каких-то военно-политических задач.
Это направляющая от того выстрела гранатомета РПГ-7, который упал ко мне на крышу. Часть мина 120-й. За последние сутки было нанесено порядка 50 ударов по территории города.
Да люди видят, вот, подойдите вы в это общежитие, они видят, как с того берега летит.
1 сентября, когда господин Гросси еще вместе с представителями Росатома ходил непосредственно по территории Запорожской атомной станции, весь материал был предоставлен. То, что именно с Украины сюда прилетают снаряды, беспилотные летательные аппараты.
Игры с атомными объектами всегда очень печально заканчиваются.
Если произойдет определенная цепная реакция, то я думаю, что земному шару спешить уже некуда будет. Здесь это затронет не только Европу, затронет весь мир.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. Trains are easily a century-old technology, yet economies are still heavily dependent on them. But are all trains, their tracks, and other gadgets on them keeping up to speed? Yes, that pun is intended. Continuing the conversation with us is Dr. Alan Zaremski. Thank you so much for sticking around to give us a little bit of Trains 101, Professor. So, Professor, are there any differences between tracks that are used for freight and passenger trains? And, I don't know, should there be?
There are different types of tracks, but the vast majority of track in the world is conventional cross-tied ballasted track. The bigger differences, you ask about the difference between high-speed rail track and conventional speed track. Now you're getting into things like the presence of curves. When you have sharper curves, or the sharper the curve, the slower you have to go around the curve. So high-speed rail, if you're building a track for a line or a line to go at 300 kilometers per hour, 200 miles an hour or so, then you need to have something that's almost perfectly straight. The curvature that's permitted for that type of track is very, very small in comparison to what's allowed for more conventional railroads. So even conventional passenger railroads and freight railroads usually have a lot more curvature because when you're going through hills and mountains, and even when you're just going through metropolitan areas, you're trying to avoid areas, you need some curvature. So those are the issues that really govern speed. We're seeing a little bit of more use of what's called slab track for higher speed rail, where instead of using conventional ballast, they will put a concrete slab and put the rails on top of a fastening system on top of the concrete slabs. But that's still the minority. The vast majority of high-speed rail track is still what I will call traditional ballasted track. Now, another difference, though, between freight and passenger and high-speed passenger track is the standards to which you build the track, the amount of deviations that you can permit. Because the faster you go, the tinier the amount of deviations you can permit. So if you're going, if you're running freight trains at 40, 50 miles an hour, you can have variations in your geometry. You can, in addition to having curvature, you can have, you know, some dips. You can have some misalignment issues. You can have one rail a little bit higher than the other and still be safe. You start increasing that speed, and the amount of those deviations that you're permitted becomes much and much less, so that the maintenance standards or the safety standards for trains going at 200 miles an hour or 300 kilometers per hour are much, much tighter than a passenger train going at 100 miles an hour or a freight train going at 60 miles an hour or 50 miles an hour.
Now, I'd like to touch upon the recent chemical freight train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. It appears there were a number of issues that contributed to the derailment from a nearly 2 mile long train with more than 150 cars to antiquated braking systems, as they say, perhaps even too few workers or engineers on that train. It wasn't just one thing, but then we learned that trains derail in the U.S. frequently. As one U.S. official said, it was about 1,000 derailments per year. Why do we have so many derailments in the U.S.? And is this something civil engineers, perhaps, you know, your students in the future, can one day solve or better for this country?
Okay. Well, I'm glad you threw me all those incorrect statements, because I've heard them all in the news, and I've been interviewed by other news media, and I've had them repeated. So let me sort of try to answer them as best as I can. So let's first of all start about, why do we have all these derailments in the United States, 1,000 or more? The reason we have all these derailments is we run so many trains. A number of years ago, I was a member of a European Union study looking at derailment of freight trains in Europe. I was the only American on that study, but I was brought in by a colleague of mine who knew me. And so I got a chance firsthand to compare derailment rates, derailments as a function of traffic in the US versus Europe. And a couple of interesting things happened. First of all, what the US calls a derailment is anything more than $12,000 worth of damage. So we have the railroad equivalent of fender benders that are counted in derailments, where in a lot of the European studies, they have to have $100,000 or more damage before they're counted. So we count all these little tiny derailments that happen in yards at very low speed with minimal damage as derailments. Then even counting those numbers, when we look at the number of derailments by the number of trains that we run, and the common unit is what's called million train miles. Millions of a train mile is one train going 1 mile, and usually we look at derailment statistics in millions of train miles. When I was doing that study in Europe, I found that the U.S. was actually sort of in the middle of the pack. Even though we were counting these fender benders, we were not as good as some European countries, but we were definitely better than some others. So we don't have this horrible number of accidents per se. We have so many accidents because we roughly carry 10 times as much freight in terms of millions of ton miles as Western Europe does, for example. So that's the first item. Okay, so now let's go back to your other issues, the long trains, the antiquated brake system, and the lack of crews. First of all, I'll say that none of those three were contributed to the cause of that derailment. The cause of that derailment was an overheated bearing, and it wasn't an overheated bearing on a tank car, by the way. The car that derailed was not one of the hazardous materials cars. It was just happened to be a car that was near one of the hazardous materials cars. The bearing seized, overheated, and very, very quickly burnt off, basically generated so much heat that it burned through the axle and derailed the train. In fact, it derailed right over one of the bearing detectors. One of the overheated bearing detectors says you have a hot bearing there. And as the train driver or train engineer was slowing the train, trying to slow the train down, the axle burst and the derail happened. So the number of cars in that train, did not affect that bearing failure. The braking system, which we'll come back to, did not affect the braking that failure. And the number, by the way, these are sealed bearings, so you can have 100 inspectors walking down the track while it stopped in the previous yard and looking at it, and they would have never seen a thing. So the number of people on the ground had nothing to do with this one either. Okay. So antiquated braking system. Well, the antiquated braking system we're talking about is the pneumatic braking system that's used by every train in the world. So the pneumatic braking system is still in use worldwide. It works on the same principle that was developed by George Westinghouse in the 1800s, but so do the brakes in Europe, and so do the brakes in China, and so do the brakes in Asia. Your China trains and your Indian trains and European trains use the same braking system. The braking valves have been upgraded. The control systems have been upgraded. And so there's no, quote, antiquated system. What you're probably referring to is what people are calling electronically controlled pneumatic brakes, or ECP, which is something that you add onto the pneumatic brakes that, instead of initiating the braking action just using the air itself, which travels down the train at the speed of sound, you add an electric line down the train, and so you initiate the exact same pneumatic brake system, but you initiate it electronically. And since it travels down the electronic line at the speed of light, it's instantaneous. The problem with that is you need an electric line in the train, and freight trains do not generally have electric lines. And not only that, you must have an electric line in every car. Now, remember, this is not a unit train. This is not a train that's put together once and never taken apart. This is a typical mixed manifest train, as used in Europe, as used in China, as used in India, as used anywhere else in the world, where you go to a yard, you disassemble the train, you make up 10 new trains from those cars and add other cars from other trains to it, and you go on your merry way to the next yard until you get to your destination. So you're constantly taking apart and putting together these trains, making up multiple cars. If you do not have an electrical wire connector in each one of those cars, if only one car was missing that electrical connector, I don't care if you have 100 cars in the train or 50 cars in the train or 20 cars in the train. One car is missing that electric connector. You can't use ECP brakes. You have to come up with some jury-rigged system to allow you to bypass it. And so for the time being, there are very, very few places in the world, like virtually none, that uses electro-pneumatic brakes on a system-wide basis for freight trains around the world. Passenger trains, you have an electrical line, so that's a different animal. But freight trains, I don't care if you're Europe, I don't care if you're China, I don't care if the U.S., with the exception of unit trains, which are permanently coupled or semi-permanently kept together, when you can keep an electric line through there, you usually don't have this kind of electric line. So the implementation of this new generation electro-pneumatic brake is something that still needs a lot of work and a lot of development and a lot of implementation. Crews. That train had a two-man crew. Two-man crew is standard worldwide for freight trains. I've heard comments there were not enough maintenance people around to make sure the systems were working. Everything I saw in the data says all the inspection systems were working fine. There was no maintenance shortage or any problems like that. Long, heavy trains. Yes, we run long, heavy trains. They're very efficient. That's one of the reasons why the World Bank shows that the North American railroads are among the most efficient railways in the world, if not the most efficient railways in the world. Yes, there's a little bit more issues involved with train handling. There's a little bit more issues involved in stopping the train properly. That's why we have, very good train crews that are trained to handle that. And yes, it's a little bit more difficult, but we're not seeing massive increases in accidents associated with that at all. And given the volume of traffic that has to be moved, the long, heavy trains seem to be the most efficient ways of moving them.
Dr. Alan Zaremski, Director of the Rail Engineering and Safety Program at the University of Delaware, thank you so much for giving us this little education on rail systems around the world. All right, I don't know about you, but I would sure like to try out an HSR train. I gotta say, I have traveled on the Eurostar train from London to Paris, and it was a wonderful experience. I got to see all the cities and towns as we sped through. I got to stand up, walk around. It was way more of an enjoyable experience than air travel. I mean, little did I know I was being green by traveling that way. So as for the U.S., we don't have HSR. And there don't appear to be any plans to build out such a system of rail across the country. Officials say because of the lack of demand. But to borrow from the movie A Field of Dreams, perhaps this is just a case of if you build it, they will come. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO. We'll be right back.